Our main speaker tonight is Joe H.
My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I want to thank Rita for inviting me to come and share. It's always an honor and a privilege to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to remember quietly before I do this who gets the credit, and that it's certainly not me or my best efforts. For 17 years, the very best I could do was drink alcohol and take a lot of drugs and mess over everybody in my life to the point where I had no one in my life. And I just kind of need to remember that before I speak. And I did that tonight with a friend, with two friends. And it's nice to have friends here tonight from the group that I belong to. And in this group, about a year ago, Clint and I met, and it's been the beginning of a wonderful friendship for me. He probably feels more of a burden, but it's been a wonderful friendship for me. And to know Cindy and Rita and several of you, it's been great. I didn't get sober here in California. I got sober in Denver, Colorado in 1982 and moved here in 1986. So I've been here about 5 years now, and I've always been felt made to feel welcome here at this group. The first time I ever was asked to do this, well, actually, the first time I was ever told to do this was I was about 7 months sober, and I had just read my first fifth step to my sponsor for most of that day, and he was the Colorado State delegate at the time, and I was used to following him around, and he took me across town to go speak. I was going to go listen to him, and we walked into this church, and there was about 200 or 300 people, which is a big meeting in Denver, and he said that he forgot to tell me, but I was going to speak first. And after that whole day of looking at the garbage of my life, I wondered, how do you do that? So I asked. I was encouraged from the very beginning to ask questions because I came here with a lot of answers. And so I asked, how do you do that? And he told me or suggested that I go in the bathroom and say a prayer and come out and see what happened. I experienced some very remarkable things that night. Actually, some of the promises that come true after the fifth step came true before I ever read them or had an idea about them, which is usually a good phenomenon for me to experience something before I understand it. I have this tendency to think that if I understand it, then I know what the experience is, and it seems in Alcoholics Anonymous almost everything that I have thought about anything is totally backwards. I've often wondered, and if you're new tonight and trying to figure out Alcoholics Anonymous with your head and think that it's some kind of intellectual process about staying sober, you're probably using the wrong organ. As I was reminded, I was using the wrong organ when I was trying to think what Alcoholics Anonymous was. It seems like it's the opposite. You wouldn't think for a guy like me that to be able to keep something that he's been given or that he could ever be given anything, that he would have to give it away. That just doesn't make sense from where I come from. And you wouldn't think that to win you need to surrender, and then admitting you don't have any power, you receive power. Just all the paradoxes in our program. I used to have a great attachment to my drunkalog. I was telling my friend on the way over that really in thinking about this tonight, I had several options. I could tell you what it was like and what it was like and what it was like, which would probably bore most everybody, including me. Or I could tell you what it was like, what happened, and who I found to blame. Or maybe I could tell you what it was like, what happened, and my opinions about that. Or maybe I could do what it suggests and tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now, rather than my terribly important opinions about Alcoholics Anonymous, which don't really mean much, nor have much to do with keeping me sober. But I remember a time when I was new, I had a great attachment to my drunkalog as far as the drama of it. And I would tell great stories and didn't really have to embellish much on them. About 10 treatment centers and the Michigan State Penitentiary and the kind of confusion that caused for a person from a family like I came from. Don't you understand? I found out something real interesting about that when some men sat down with me who were willing to take a risk, and risk my sensitive alcoholic feelings to tell me the truth, which didn't always feel good. And they sat down with me and they asked me a question that I'm as guilty as anybody else of not asking that much anymore, except when someone asked me for help. They asked me, why did I think I was an alcoholic? And I thought, my God, you know, how dare you? And I said, well, I've been to 10 treatment centers. They said, well, that's probably not good enough. A lot of hard drinkers go to treatment more than once. They're just stupid. They drink tremendous amounts of alcohol, and they're about as much alcoholic as a man in the moon. But alcohol put me in the Michigan State Penitentiary. They said, wrong. A lot of hard drinkers go to the Michigan State Penitentiary who can drink tremendous amounts of alcohol. They're about as much alcoholic as the man in the moon, and some of us have never been to the penitentiary or treatment. What does that mean? We're not? And I started to find something very interesting out about that. I started to find out, number one, that I was terribly sick because I wanted to fit in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I realized one day that normal people don't just walk down the street and decide that I'd really like to fit in with those people in AA. Because I realized one day that I wanted to be a part of this. That was terribly strange. And then I realized I was using the things that separate me from you to tell you why I was one of you. And these men, with their kindness and love, started to talk to me about what the preamble says, and they started to share their experience, strength, and hope with me that we could look at a common problem. And they started to talk to me about the common problem of alcoholism, and I no longer felt separate because I wasn't using the things that separate me from you to tell you why I was one of you. And I started to lose this great attachment that I had and still have from time to time to circumstance and drama and emotional state to tell you why I'm one of you and what my problem is. I used to think that how I felt had something to do with God being in my life. And I would stand at these podiums or share in a meeting or sit in my living room with somebody and I would say, I know God's working in my life because I feel good today. And somebody said to me one time, what are you worshiping, God or your emotions? Is it possible God can be there when you're not feeling really great? And then my ego takes that and shifts up on me and says, well, I know God's working in my life because there was a parking place just for me outside of the meeting. And things are going my way in my life. They're going good. And somebody said to me, what are you worshiping? God, or things going your way like you've done all your life? And I also started to see that emotional state and circumstance didn't have much to do with me drinking either. guy came up to me one time and he said, you know, more has been revealed. These people that wrote the book really only knew a little. And now in the 90s, we've come to find out it's not really a threefold disease of the body, the mind, and the spirit. It's a feeling disease. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. Did you drink when you felt bad? He said, yeah. I said, did you drink when you felt good? He said, yeah. I said, did you drink when you weren't feeling much at all? He said, yeah. I said, then what the heck does alcohol care about how you feel, whether you drink it again or not? And I started to see that that was the truth of my life. From the top to the bottom, to Skid Row, from city to city, from drink to drink. Didn't matter much how I felt, whether she was there, whether she had left, whether the team won, whether the team lost, whether it was rainy or sunny, or I felt real bad, or I felt real good, or I wasn't feeling much at all, or I wanted to feel anything, or I didn't want to feel at all, or circumstances were great, or everything was a mess. I drink alcohol, and I drink alcohol in a certain way that these men started to talk to me about, and no one had ever talked to me about drinking this way. They started to talk to me about taking the drama of where my drinking took me. They said simple things like, the most you'll ever find out about where your drinking took you was where your drinking took you. And I said, what about how I feel? They said, how long have you been in therapy? My God, you became a therapist in a treatment center. When I met my sponsor, he said, Joe, you know enough about alcoholism and how you feel and yourself to be dangerous to you and everyone around you. And I'd say things like, but I feel terribly inferior and insecure. And my sponsor's eyes would light up and he'd say, you want to know why? And I'd say, yeah, I've been looking for the reason to that all my life. He said, you really want to know why you feel inferior and insecure? And I said, yeah, I really do. He said, because you're inferior and insecure. And I would, the simplicity of that. It's not Freudian. It's not real heavy. And there's no one to blame. I spent a great deal of my life drunk and sober, like the guy who's been sober forever, and God forbid he's on his deathbed. God forbid. And his wife is there in the hospital, and he looks up at his wife and he says, honey, after all these years, I've realized something. And she says, what's that? He says, well, you were right there that time I got shot. And you stood by me. And you were right there that time I had a stroke. And you stood by me. And you were right there that time I lost all our money in business. And you stood by me. And you've always been right there, and you've always stood by me, and after all these years, I've realized one thing. And she says, what's that? And he says, you are a frigging jinx. And I heard that, and I thought to myself, you know, that's how I think. It's always them, or it, or... For us guys, her is a good one, you know. A couple years ago, I was living here in Santa Monica, and I was engaged to be married. And she left me. And I went around to meetings for a couple days, and I was just, you know, milking the heck out of it. She left me. And a friend of mine said to me, why don't you go home and write inventory about her leaving you? And this wonderful inventory process outlined in our big book has been such a saving grace for me throughout these years, because it takes what I think is true and it turns it into a lie, and it takes what I think is the lie and it turns it into the truth. And I go home and I put her name in the left-hand column of a piece of paper. And then in the next column of that piece of paper, I put, she left me. And then I was asked to examine seven areas of self and why they were hurt and threatened and started to see some things that were going on that my ego tells me, and I started to see things like her leaving me affects my sense self-esteem, because I believe no one should ever leave me no matter what I do. And it affects my security because I need her to be okay. And these lies that my ego tells me. And then I was given the grace to see where my selfishness and my dishonesty and my self-seeking and my fear drove her away. And that she didn't leave. And I had to do a few more simple things, and then I had to go knock on her door, and I had to say a few things to her, and I got free, and she didn't have to come back or change. And I think somewhere in the middle of this process, I started to learn a few years ago, and I started to experience the difference between relief and freedom. I had feelings about a father before I ever drank, about how old he was when I was born. My father was 57 years old when I was born, and that used to cause me great pain. Now that gives me great hope. This is a smart group. They usually don't get that one. I'd like to be doing what my father was doing when he was 57 years old, when I'm 57 years old. And I went to therapy for 12 years and to find out the answer to this question in the back of my mind that was there before I ever took a drink. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I mean, my God, when I worked in the field drinking with the director of the program that I worked for, some people actually thought I was there to help somebody. They didn't know I was just there to find out the answer to that question that had been bugging me for a long time. What's wrong with me? And I remember a period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and from time to time since then, waking up in the middle of the night and wondering, what's wrong with me? And I did some simple things that were suggested that I do, and rather than beating on a chair or sharing it with the group or crying about it, which would give me relief until the next time I saw him or thought about him or even thought about going to his grave after he died or seeing my mother's face, those same feelings would come back. In this program, I was asked to do some things that made no logical sense whatsoever. And walked out of his graveyard, walked out of the graveyard that he's buried in, after doing what I was told to do at his grave, free. And for 8.5 years, those feelings have not come back. Feelings of anger and hate and jealousy and were healed. Today there's respect and admiration. Sorry that I didn't take a little more advantage of a wise man that could have taught me a lot, because I was consumed with my resentment about how old I thought he should be and what he should be doing, and failed to see that I had two older brothers that were doing all the things that I wanted him to do. And I searched the world for this answer to what's wrong with me. And some men sit down with me in Alcoholics Anonymous and start to share their experience with me, and I start to look at how I drank. And I start to look at how I drank by taking all the drama of where it took me and looking at two simple points that our big book spends a whole lot of time looking at just to get across two little ideas. What happens to me when I start to drink, and what happens to me every time I stop drinking? And I started to see, and I started to get a little bit of an answer as to what's wrong with me. And I started to find out the answer to day after day after day after day of my drinking that I can talk to you about, that I think was important for me to talk about, that was important for me to look at, without all the drama that separates me from some of you. I can tell you about the day of my father's funeral when I was literally begged not to drink, brought from a little white room in a mental institution to my father's funeral, and asked my mother, could I go across the street to say hello to a friend? And I didn't want to drink. I told her I will not show up at my father's funeral drunk. And I went across the street to say hello to a friend, and he asked me, did I want to have a beer? And I said, I'll have two just to calm down. And somewhere between the second one and the 20th one, I lost the kind of power that it takes to decide how many I was going to have or choose. Because I didn't want to show up at my father's funeral drunk, and I did, to the point where the guard that brought me tied me to a tree by my ankle with a chain at my father's funeral. And I didn't want to do that. 2.5 years later, they let me out of the Michigan State Penitentiary, and for 28 days, I had every sufficient reason in the world not to take a drink. I made my second report to my PO 28 days later, and I hadn't had a drink in 28 days. He told me why I shouldn't. He told me the conditions of my parole. He told me how good I was doing. And I walked out of his office with a silly idea that I needed a pack of cigarettes, into a bar, picked up a drink, woke up 5 days later, had broke every condition of my parole. And I didn't want to do that. And I didn't know why I did that. I heard George Carlin a few months ago on HBO, and he talked about a couple things that were of interest to me. He said, you know, we live in a society that believes if you change the name of the condition, you can change the condition. And he gave several examples, and I thought to myself, you know, my God, we do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. Rather than admit to you that I have a threefold disease of body, mind, and spirit that no human power can relieve, maybe now in the 90s it's just low self-esteem coupled with obsessive compulsive behavior. Doesn't that at least sound like something? If I can't make it go away by myself, we can all make it go away together, right? Then you're given the grace to write inventory the way it's outlined in our big book, and you see that you've probably had more esteem for yourself than anyone in the world would ever even care to have for you. And drank. And you're given the grace to write inventory and see that you've probably had less esteem for yourself than anyone in the world would ever even care to have for you, and didn't drink. So I think if it's not obvious by now that where I'm concerned, I have just a little bit more than low self-esteem. Now what about obsessive compulsive behavior? I like wintergreen lifesavers. Right? I really like wintergreen lifesavers. My friends know if you want a wintergreen lifesaver, ask me, right? I'm probably a little obsessive. I'm probably a little compulsive with my wintergreen lifesaver usage. But you really have to stretch my mind to convince me that's the same as alcoholism. I smoke Marlboros. I'm addicted to nicotine. Some of you drink large, tremendous amounts of coffee. Now, if addiction and alcoholism are the same, and thank God some men sat down with me who were clear on the difference, and they talked to me because I did a lot of drugs. And I didn't know what I was. Am I an addict? Am I an alcoholic? Am I an alcoholic addict? Am I an addict that drank too much? Am I an alcoholic that took too many drugs? And these men started to talk to me about the difference. And I started to see that I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over alcohol once I start to drink it because I crave more booze. And I'm powerless over alcohol when I stop drinking it because I just can't keep myself sober. Every sufficient reason that has ever been given to me in my life, wealth, opportunity, judges, girlfriends, parole officers, wanting to stop, never lasted more than 28 days for 17 years. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talked to me about denial. And you would have thought that as badly beaten as I was, that there wouldn't have been much denial to break through. And that's a form of denial that we all know about and we all hear about. And you go to treatment or you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they talk to you about the denial of the disease of alcoholism. A couple years ago, I found within myself a form of denial stronger than the denial I came here with, because I haven't had a drink for several years and it's still there. And it comes out in me real subtle. I get up to take a cake. Somebody in the back of the room says, "How did you do it?" And I admit that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Then I tell you for about 15 or 20 minutes how I've managed to keep myself sober and manage my life. Or those days when I wake up and I start to take the credit. Boy, look at what I've done. Boy, look at how my life is. And I started to get in touch with the denial of the grace of God. And I started to really think that I was dealing with something here that's deserved. I remember the first time I went to my sponsor, and it was either something really good or something really bad. It doesn't matter much when you're new, but I went to him and I said, "Don, I don't deserve this." And he said, "Thank God." He said, "If everyone in these rooms got what they deserved, we'd be sitting in empty rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Maybe we're dealing with a God of mercy and grace." And I tend to think sometimes that this wonderful work I've done with the steps and in the fellowship and of being of service has something to do with what I've been given. And if it is, then I'm dealing with some kind of God that's on a kind of a payroll kind of thing. And I started to realize by doing a lot of work that it's none of the work I've done that's given me what I have. That this thing is an absolute, undeserved, unearned gift. But it takes a lot of work on a daily basis to remember that, to keep that channel clear. I remember the first time I heard my sponsor say that no one in this room, and he was talking to me because I heard him, he said, "No one in this room will ever be closer to God than they are right now. No one in this room will ever be closer to God than they were on their last drunk. The only thing that'll change here is your awareness of that presence. Because He doesn't move. He's always been right there." It took a lot of work for me to realize that it's none of this great work I've done that keeps me sober. That there's really nothing I can do to keep myself sober. And they give you all this stuff to do just to keep you busy long enough to realize that. I remember the first time I took the third step, and I got up off my knees and I asked my sponsor the great mystery question in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know those times where you share some terrible problem and some idiot in the back of the room says, "Just turn it over." And you want to take him and you want to strangle him and you want to say, "You know, if I knew how to do that, I wouldn't be here." And maybe when on your second birthday or something, they'll show you this little secret button you press to just turn everything over. And after reaching a point in Alcoholics Anonymous where I literally hit bottom with the second half of step one and saw that my life is unmanageable sober, and that my life being manageable has nothing to do with what's going on out here. It has to do with a malady inside of me that I've been trying to find an answer and pouring alcohol and drugs on for 17 years to overcome, was in full bloom further away from my last drink than I'd ever been. I don't know where I got this idea, but I somehow had this idea from treatment that alcoholism begins with the first drink and ends with the last drink. If that's true, it's a real joke that I'm here tonight, because I certainly wouldn't be here 9 years after my last drink if my disease ended. I started to get in touch with a part of my disease that progresses on past the last drink, and these men started to talk to me about the root of my disease. this spiritual malady. I always thought it was just an emotional state. Or if circumstances were better, I'd be okay. And then I get the dream and I'm still empty inside. Or I get the woman and I'm empty inside. Or she finally leaves and I'm empty inside. Or whatever little scheme I had to what needed to go on for me to feel better has happened and is still there. I found it described in our book really well in several places, this thing that I suffer from. And I reached that point at 5.5 months, and I went to a man and I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said he only knew one way to do that, that I would go to a meeting every day, at least one, and that I would get involved in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I would get involved in the recovery process of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he sat there for about a half an hour, and he talked to me about our little circle and our triangle that I didn't know anything about before I met him. And I saw that I was in one-third of the program expecting the results of the other two-thirds, and that I was expecting the results of recovery and service hanging out in the fellowship, and that me going to meetings did not mean I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. It meant I was a member of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that there was a recovery process, and that there was a program of service, and that one day that might become whole, and I wouldn't know the difference between whatever I'm doing in AA as to what part of it it is. And that came through for me too. And he started taking me through that big book. And he started to take me through that big book from a point of view that we weren't looking for information, we weren't going to dot the I's and cross the T's, and we weren't going to look for answers. We were going to look for questions for me to consider and directions on how to have a spiritual experience. And I started to lose the trap that information has anything to do with power, and that I wasn't studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started to realize that it would be about like studying how to have an orgasm and going to college and learning everything there is to learn about what it would be like to have one. And then becoming a professor at Harvard University, the utmost authority on what it would be like to have an orgasm, but you've never had one. And your little twin brother goes out and all he does is find a little girl to show him how to have one. Who knows more about what it would be like to have one? And I started to go for this experience rather than what I could learn about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became convinced in a place that wasn't up here. It was kind of like a gut-level admission that I really am powerless over alcohol and that I really can't manage my own life. And once the last drop of virtue was squeezed out of that, I was about as open to step two as anything I'd ever been open to. I love when I'm working with somebody and they say they're having trouble with step two. And those of you that have been around here for a little while, the next time you hear that from somebody, just talk to them about step one. Because I found out if I'm having trouble with step two, it's not with step two, it's with step one. I'm really not convinced of the nature of my condition. And when all the virtue of going to God was snuffed out of my first step admission, I chose a conception that would work for me, and that conception had very little to do with any ideas I had about God. It had to do with, if lack of power is my problem, then maybe I need some power. Where am I going to find it? And it's amazing that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the very next thing it said when I became convinced of that was exactly where and how to find it. And that that would be my question, and that that was my question, and then told me that was the main purpose of this book, to find this power. And I made a decision, and I got up off my knees, and I asked my sponsor the greatest question I ever learned to ask in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, if that was just a decision, then how do you turn it over? And I remembered back to several months earlier when I was about 90 days sober, and I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in North Denver, Colorado, and I was doing the old AA shuffle. I turned it over and I took it back. And I turned it over and I took it back. And this old man said to me, "Son, if you're still doing that, you haven't turned it over." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's a difference between the decision at the third step and the commitment that follows." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's a difference between a decision and a commitment. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's like a chicken and a pig walking down the road. And they come to a big sign on this church that says, help feed the poor. And the chicken looks at the pig and he's all pumped up with virtue because he loves to do nice things for people. And he says to the pig, we ought to do something about that hunger problem. And the pig says, what in the world could we ever do about a hunger problem? And the chicken says, we could feed those poor people ham and eggs. And the pig had a little more sense than I did when I took the third step, because he said to the chicken, for you, that's just a simple decision to lay some eggs, but for me, that's one hell of a commitment. Because we're talking about my life. And when I became convinced that we were talking about life and death here, and it wasn't just a frolic in the park with your sponsor, going to run off to seek God, I became convinced of three pertinent ideas. And I took that third step and I got up off my knees and I asked my sponsor, if that was just a decision, then how do you turn it over? And he didn't just lay some cliche on me. He said, son, can you count from 4 to 9? And I said, yeah, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. He said, that's the way we turn our wills and our lives over to the care of God. By taking direct action against the will, contrary to the way we've lived our lives. And I don't know about you, but for me, every single thing I was asked to do in step four was totally against my will. And totally opposite from the way I had lived my life for 30 years. And then to read that whole thing to one man. And then to ask something other than me to remove that stuff. I love when I hear somebody on step 6 and 7 for several months. They're going to list their defects and work on them one at a time, and they know what order they should be worked in. My sponsor said, I think maybe those are the steps where God's supposed to do something, and you'll know you've done 6 and 7 when you're doing 8. And I remember sitting in my own home group about a year ago, and I actually had the audacity to say, I'm praying for the willingness to make amends. And a guy in my group that I had worked with, I mean, please. He said, you know how you'll know when you're willing to make amends? I said, no, how will I know when I'm willing to make amends? He said, you'll start to hear strange noises. I thought, come on now. This is getting a little extreme. I'll start to hear weird noises. He said, yeah, when you're willing to make amends, you'll start to hear strange noises. And I said, like what? And he said, like this. And you know, the day I was willing to make amends to that girl who had left me, who I really saw I drove away, I heard a strange noise, and I was knocking on her door. And you start to hear busy signals and pens writing on pieces of paper. And to make that kind of a list and go to those people and talk to them about the kind of harm I caused them and ask them what I can do to make it right is absolutely against my will, contrary to the way I've lived my life for 30 years. And I started to see, by taking direct action against the will, contrary to the way I've lived my life, I was given back a life that I couldn't even have imagined. And I was given back a will that I could begin to use along a certain line. Because of some people in this program that have what I want, and people like some of you that I know in this room that have what I want, I've continued to be involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned a lot about commitment from people in this group that I've become close to. And I learned a lot about commitment from my sponsor. And I've continued to be involved in the recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've tried to continue to be of service. I've been fortunate to work with a lot of people for a young person in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just love doing that. And for a guy like me to say that he loves sitting in his living room thinking about somebody else and what he can do for him, and watching that person change and watch God come into his life and change him, isn't the way I lived before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous.
The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meeting. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Lindsay J.
My name is Lindsay Jackson, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Rita, for allowing me to share at this meeting. It is an honor to share at any AA meeting, and especially my home group. It is an honor to be sober. I am so grateful to be sober today. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous afraid that I could not stop drinking. I heard that this was a place where you could learn to not drink. And I had good examples of that in my life. I had an aunt who was sober, who had been sober for many years. And I had the man that 12-stepped me, who I had dated for a time prior to my getting sober. And he was a very good example. But somehow, I knew that I could not stop drinking, and I didn't think it would work for me, but I was so desperate when I came in here that I was willing to try anything. I'm so glad this program is such a wonderful, loving, and joyous program, because I would have done anything to stay sober. If, you know, whip me, beat me, whatever. And I wasn't into that. I was into some things, but not that. When I got sober, I say this, I suffered from alcoholism, and along with that, slutism. And my slutism was really a result of my alcoholism, but I didn't know it at the time. And if you suffer from those things, we have an answer here. I am so grateful that I found an answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to my first meeting, I came, I was an overweight slut. I was very heavy. I was bloated is what I was. And I went to my first meeting. It was a morning meeting over in West Hollywood, a little clubhouse on Robertson near Melrose at 7:30 in the morning, because I had spent the evening before with this guy that 12-stepped me, and I thought I admitted at possibly I was an alcoholic. I had a lot of yeah buts. I had yeah, but I'm not on Skid Row. Yeah, but I haven't lost my job yet. It just occurred to me now. I have just turned 7 in Alcoholics Anonymous, which for the newcomers means that I have not had anything, alcohol, pills, anything that would affect me from the neck up for 7 years, and that is a real miracle, and for that I am very grateful. But it took me 7 years, I'm a little slow in some areas, to realize, it just hit me, the reason I didn't lose my job is because I was self-employed, pretty much. So, it takes some people longer than others, but I still had my children, although I had a big fear that I was going to lose my children. I used to be afraid. I had anxiety attacks during my drinking years that got worse and worse as the time progressed. I remember having to pull off the freeway because my heart was beating so fast and I couldn't breathe. And I thought that I had a heart condition. I went to the doctor and he examined me. We took pictures of my heart. We did everything. And they couldn't really find anything wrong. And so I didn't know. He said it was, at first it was housewife phobia. That was when I was married. Later on, I guess we couldn't really find a name for it. But I know what it was. It was a result of my alcoholism, of my drinking. My body was getting really bad, really run down, and I was killing myself. It was killing me. But I didn't know that then. I did not know I was an alcoholic. When I went to the doctor for things like that, and also toward the end, I had a flu. Every day I had a flu. I'm so stupid. I didn't know. It was a hangover. That's what it was. And I remember after 3 weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember a couple of realizations. The first one was that I hadn't had a drink in 3 weeks. And I was so grateful. And I remember thinking, I could tell my kids now, maybe I could stay sober. And I remember telling making the big announcement to my two daughters, saying, have you noticed anything different? And they said, no, what? And I said, I haven't had a drink in 3 weeks. Oh, really? You know, that was, and I was shocked because I thought it was so obvious to everyone. And then they did say, because I did, you know, a lot of closet drinking in the end. I waited. They went to sleep early. I put them to bed and drank. They went to sleep earlier and earlier as time progressed because I had to drink. And, they did say, that's right, you haven't been throwing up lately. Because I used to go in and throw up almost every night toward the end. And I thought that was because I drank, I tried to eat to get sober. I was in real estate at the time. The phone would ring at night. I couldn't talk on the phone toward the end. I knew I was slurring my words. I never had blackouts, but I had brownouts. I knew I had talked to this person, but I don't remember exactly what I said. Things like that. But I did throw up almost every night. Some of it was self-induced, and toward the end it wasn't. And I thought, oh, well, that's just my body catching on to the, you know, I don't have to self-induce it anymore. My body has caught on to it. This is a sick, sick gal. And so I came in really, I couldn't stop drinking at the end. I was a periodic for years, off and on, and if you knew what that means, is that I was able to control my drinking for periods of time. And the periods of time got shorter and shorter until at the very end, there were no periods of time in between. I had to drink every day. I could wait till 5, and then I'd start shaking. I had an answer for the shaking. I thought I had low blood sugar. And, you know, everything but alcoholism. I didn't get it. Well, I do understand now, and I've been told here that this is a disease of denial, and that's why I just didn't get it. I was in denial. I had been told about alcoholism. I had a lot of people around me that were good and bad examples, and everyone in my family practically drank, and but it was my denial. So I'm just glad that that I was able to come in here and in the shape that I was and say, what do I do? I'll do anything. Because I, at that point, the point at which I realized I could not stop drinking anymore, I felt like I was going to die. I felt like I was doomed. And so somehow, and I don't know how it happened, but when I came in the doors and I went to that first meeting, that is my sobriety date. I haven't had a drink since that day. I did everything that I was asked to do here. I did things that I heard might help. I would listen to conversations, and I was told that washing cups might help. We had cups that we washed at that first meeting, so I did that. I heard that getting a sponsor would help. If you're new, getting a sponsor is getting someone, another AA member who's hopefully active in AA, to help you along, to tell you what they did, to show you what they did, and hopefully you will do what they did. And That's what I did. I got a sponsor, and I took her direction. And in the beginning, the first year was very hard for me. I was in a very bad marriage. We were miserable when we met. We went together a year, and we were miserable after we got married. And I was told some things to do that were very hard for me. I was told to be a good wife to this man who basically couldn't stand me or my children and was very abusive, and not to be abusive back. And then I was told to go to a meeting every day and every night or every day, and I did that too. And I was told to read the big book. And in the beginning, I was absolutely shocked that I could not read more than a few sentences at a time and understand what it was saying. I just did. I was shocked because I was an avid reader. But I was not in good shape, and I was in worse shape than I thought I was. And the longer I'm sober, the more I realize how bad I really was. Because when you're in it, you don't see it. But I have been here for 7 years. I found this group when I was 8 months sober. And it was really exciting because I came here, and everybody that I'd ever heard share at my other groups that was wonderful were here, and I knew this is where I wanted to be. My life is fabulous today, and I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous and a kind and loving God and this group. Thank you very much.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Jim Jay.
My name is Jim Malloy, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Rita, for asking me to participate in this meeting. It's always an honor to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When the leader called Jim Jay, I thought, oh, great, it wasn't me after all. I thought I could sit there and watch someone, Jim Jay, get up and do my talk for me. But, you know, whenever I'm asked to share at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I always say I will, no matter how scared I feel or no matter what's going on in my life at the time. And I learned that here. I'm an alcoholic of the blackout type. I would drink, and anything could happen. It was like going on a Star Trek trip or something like that. You know, I could end up in a different town. I could end up in a city jail or in a strange place where I'd never been before of any type. I could end up waking up outside on the street, lying on the lawn, watching the early morning traffic go by. You know, anything could happen. But for a long time in my drinking, alcoholic really worked for me. Alcohol made me feel invincible. It made me feel that I was funny. It made it possible for me to talk to women. It made me feel like a man. And I am really very, very grateful that alcoholic did all those things for me, because when I was a young kid growing up, feeling the way I felt, if I hadn't have found something to make me feel like I just described, I don't think that I would be alive today. Because there has been times in my life when, for medical reasons or other reasons, when I had to stop drinking. And during those times, you know, I did things to really hurt myself. I didn't want to die or anything, but I really wanted people to know the kind of pain that I was in. And I came close on one occasion to dying. I'll tell you about something that happened to me at the end of my drinking. It's just one of many things that happened to me. I learned that I was an alcoholic by going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it was the first meeting I'd been to, and I learned I was an alcoholic right off the bat. And it came to me as a real shock. Even though my family, my cousins and uncles, and a lot of people where I am from, a lot of people in my family had died as a result of alcoholism, but I never thought of alcohol being a problem because of all the good things it did for me. But I found out that I was an alcoholic, and I found it necessary to go out and drink for another couple of years. And during that time, a lot of terrible things happened to me. Not very many good things happened to me at all. But you know, a normal night out for me would be like, you know, I went to a bar one night and I started drinking, and you know, and the blinds went down, and you know, I blacked out, and you know, I woke up the next morning. I was lying on a table outside the bar. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and the traffic was going by, and I felt in my pockets. You know, my wallet was gone. I went out. I had $500 in my wallet when I went out that night. You know, my pants were wet from having wet myself. You know, and I felt like a piece of dirt. You know, and I got on my motorbike and I started driving back home to the wife that I had at that time. And I was thinking up of the lies that I could tell her. You know, on the way home. And I came off my motorbike, and I kind of slid across the road, and you know, I cut all my legs up and my face up, and you know, I got back on that bike and got home, and my wife at that time was a nurse, and she cleaned me up, and you know, and she put bandages on my legs and cleaned my face up and everything, and put me to bed like a little boy, you know, like she was dealing with just a little kid. And she went to work, and I woke up at 2 o'clock that afternoon, needing a drink. You know, and I got back out on that motorbike and went back to that same bar, and I couldn't move my mouth. There was scabs forming all over my face, and I couldn't move my mouth wide enough to open my mouth to get the drink down my throat. So I got a straw, you know, and I sat there and just sucked on the straw, you know, and alcohol wasn't working for me anymore. That might, you know. I was still trying to make it work, but it wasn't doing it anymore. You know, it really wasn't doing it anymore. I got sober 4 years, 5 months, and 11 days ago. And when I was 4 days sober, I came to this meeting. And, you know, I sat at the back and I saw all the people here dressed up, and they were clean, and they were looking good, and they were laughing, and they were smiling. You know, and I was terrified. You know, I was sweating, and you know, I couldn't. I thought I'd come to the wrong place or something, because you know, I couldn't believe that all these people were alcoholics, because they couldn't be alcoholics and not drink and feel and look the way they did and seem to be so happy. You know, I just couldn't understand it. But that night, you know, I got a sponsor. Someone shook my hand and they gave me their card and they told me to call them when I got home. And when I got home, I called them. And they asked me, was I willing to do anything that I thought was necessary in order to stay sober? And I told them that I was willing to do that. You know, I was beaten. You know, there was nothing left inside. You know, and that person gave me a set of instructions for things for me to do the next day, like go to a meeting, like get up in the morning, you know, and shave and brush my teeth, you know, and call these people and do this and do that, you know. And by the end of the day, I'd get to the meeting, you know, and he was there to meet me, and he talked to me some more, you know. And then the day started going by, you know, and every day I would have something to do, you know, and my mind was. I was physically and mentally occupied with doing things that I didn't understand, that I just didn't understand. But you know, time seemed to go by and I didn't take a drink. You know, I didn't take a drink. I have had a lot of times in this sobriety where I have felt that there was nothing I could do but take a drink. You know, because the outside world would be coming in on me so hard and the pain would be so bad that I just didn't want to be in my own skin. You know, and there was times when I would just want to hit myself on the head with a baseball bat just to not feel the way I felt. But you know, I got through them times. I got through them times because I knew that I had other things to do. You know, there was a commitment to do that night. There was a meeting to go to that night, or there was someone I had to meet, or there was someone I had to call. You know, there was always something else for me to do. And when them times were really hard, it got me through. It got me through the bad times. The training to do things that I didn't want to do and I didn't think were necessary to do, the training that made me do them things anyway, got me through the times when I didn't know what to do. Sobriety has been very, very good to me. It's been very, very good to me. You know, when I first got sober, you know, when people would say, hello, how are you doing? My name is this, you know, I'd hold my head down, you know, and say, Yeah, my name's Jim. You know, how are you doing? You know, I couldn't look people in the face, you know, and it's possible for me to stand up here tonight and, you know, there's 900 people here, you know, and I still feel a little bit of fear, but, you know, I'm here and I'm talking and I feel good about myself. I got married again in this program. I got married to a girl who got sober with me, you know, and we have a little son. His name is Seamus, and he's 3 months old, and, you know, I never thought that I could have them things. You know, I never really thought that I could have them things. Things, I have made things a little bit difficult for myself recently, you know, by thinking too much. You know, that's the truth. That's the truth. You know, my life is better than it's ever been. And yet, you know, I go to bed at night thinking about how I'm going to do this, how I'm going to do that. And I wake up in the morning thinking about the same things. You know, and what my sponsor tells me is I got to let go. I'm not in control. I'm not God. You know, there's a plan for my life, but it isn't my plan. You know, and I got to just sit back and do certain things and enjoy life. You know, and I'm trying to do that today. I have a sponsor in my life who I really love and respect, and he's done a lot of things to help me make my life better. You know, he's told me to do things that I just didn't understand. You know, and I did them things, and lo and behold, things in my past would come to clear up, and I wouldn't feel bad about certain things anymore. You know, and you know, I still don't understand quite how it happens today, but you know. You know, if you're new to this program, you know, find someone like you, like I found, and listen to them, and just sit and listen to them, and do the things that they ask you to do. You know, your life will get better. I love this program. I love the people in it, and I want to thank you for letting me participate.
Birthdays at this meeting, and we consider sobriety to be 365 days free from alcohol, pills, heroin, anything that affects our emotions. We have a few birthdays this evening, the first of which is for 6 years for Sally P.
I'm Sally. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Marilyn Slater, my higher power, Clancy, and for his structure. Well, I did something wrong. Thank you. Thank you very much.
She didn't mean Clancy was her higher power. Okay. Happy birthday, Sally. We have a 15-year birthday for our treasurer, Judy R.
Hi, my name is Judy Ross. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, I am very grateful to God for the gift of sobriety, and I hope I always treat it like a special gift. I want to thank my first sponsor, Maggie V, for a year and a half of love and good direction. I want to thank Susie for the last 13 and a half years. She is an incredible lady, and I want to be just like her when I grow up. I love and respect her very, very much, and I trust her implicitly, and it took a long time for me to do that. And she's always been on my side. I want to thank the women that I sponsor. They're very important to me, and I care about them very, very much. I want to thank Clancy and all the old-timers in this group for continuing to carry on the traditions of this group, and I want to thank Clancy for starting this group so that I would have a place to come on Wednesday night and a place to get sober. I was very alone and very afraid when I came here 15 years ago, and I'm not alone anymore. Thank you very much.
Happy birthday, Judy. We have a 16-year birthday for Ben R. Happy birthday.
My name is Ben. I'm an alcoholic. The reason I do this, I got fresh with a little lady from Pasadena. She knocked my tooth out. I want to thank Millie for giving me that cake. Also want to thank Millie for being my sponsor and my good friend, and I value her friendship very much. I also would like to thank Clancy for the structure of the group. and Clancy and Charlotte for being my friends. I have a lot of thank yous here. I want to thank the class of 75 for accepting me as one of their members. Also like to thank the Pacific Group for accepting me too and making my visits here very comfortable. I want a special thank to three very good friends who've been taking me to meetings and making it comfortable for me to go to meetings almost every night. I also would like to thank AA as a whole, and I want to thank my God for making all this possible. And I thank you all for being here, and I love you, and God bless you.
Happy birthday, Ben. Ben is 91 years old with 16 years of sobriety. Isn't that great? That's all the birthdays this evening. We do have some out-of-town birthdays. Actually, this birthday was several months ago. It was for Joe Madrid for 20 years, for 21 years. He also sent us his birthday candle money last year, and we did not announce his birthday, or it wasn't on the tape. No. It was, might have been announced, but it wasn't on the tape. And that's for Joe Madrid from Northern California. Happy birthday, Joe. We had a total of four birthdays tonight and celebrating 78 years of sobriety. We have a birthday candle custom in this group, and that is that if you have celebrated a birthday this evening, we ask that if you would like to volunteer, that you pay $1 for each candle on your cake. If you'll go back to the back of the room and see our treasurer, Judy, she will hold that money until the end of the year. Last year, we had over $5,000 that we contributed to General Service in New York, and that says quite a bit for this group. I also would like to remind you that...